Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for farmers and composters. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner Senecal. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing high-quality compost. We are going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. In today's episode of The Composter, my guest is Ron Alexander from R. Alexander Associates. I reached out to Ron because quite a few composters and compost users have been rightly concerned with the high levels of phosphorus that can be found in composts, especially when manure is a feedstock. Phosphorus leaching is a serious water pollution issue. I had read an article in BioCycle written by Ron about how phosphorus in organic matter releases differently, more slowly, than inorganic water-soluble phosphorus found in inorganic fertilizers, and thought we should dig deeper into that. Ron has over 35 years' experience in composting. He has worked with over 200 composting and organics recycling facilities throughout North America and the world. He's received numerous awards, such as the High Kellogg Award for Outstanding Service to the Composting Industry, and named by BioCycle as an organics recycling trailblazer. Listen in to hear more from Ron Alexander. Today's episode of The Composter is brought to you by BioCycle. Founded in 1960, BioCycle is the go-to resource on composting, organics recycling, anaerobic digestion and biogas, end product markets, policies and regulations, and community outreach and education. It's where I go to keep up with composting news. I have learned a tremendous amount by signing up for the BioCycle Connect, the twice-monthly free e-newsletter on BioCycle's website, biocycle.net. I highly recommend checking it out. This episode is also brought to you by ComTech. Today, more than ever, people are discovering the benefits of compost in gardens, landscapes, and agriculture. However, as composting awareness grows, so does consumer demand. As a result, commercial composters are seeking ways to increase year-round production while maintaining high levels of quality in their compost. For many, the solution is a better process. For over 25 years, ComTech has worked with scientists, agriculture experts, and customers to develop a proven four-step process that produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. This process is known as shred, turn, screen, and separate. You can learn more about the ComTech process at comtechamericas.com/composterpodcast. While you're there, request a complimentary consultation to discover if the ComTech process is right for your commercial operation. On our farm, EarthCare Farm, screening used to be the bottleneck in our process. We now have a ComTech M2 multi-star screener, and it has made our composting process much more efficient. ComTech Americas is proud to support the Composter podcast and is ready to help you make the most of a great opportunity. And now, back to the show. Good morning, Ron Alexander. Welcome to The Composter.
Thank you, Jean. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I've been reading your work over many years, and I'm really, really excited to get to talk to you today. Ron, could you tell us about your career path and what led you to be a consultant for the compost industry?
Sure. Well, I went to school in Pennsylvania, Ag School, and I studied horticulture. Both landscaping and then production of fruits and vegetables. So I studied plants and soils. And while I was there my senior year, I actually did research, greenhouse research on the reuse of biosolids. Really, it was septage back then. And kind of did interesting research. And then the first national or East Coast compost brokerage company just happened to be in the same town this ag school I went to was. And I joined that company and became one of the first full-time compost salesmen. This is back in 84, so it's a million years ago. And the company was quite successful. We marketed a lot of compost out of several facilities. And I ended up making a change and joining ENA Environmental. Elliot Epstein, who was, I consider, one of the grandfathers of the composting industry in this country, hired me. And he had a company that helped develop facilities and also did organic byproduct management. But they kind of didn't have anybody who worked on product development and bringing products to market. So I got this wonderful opportunity for 7 years to work with kind of one of my heroes in the industry. And that, they kind of brought me into the consultancy world. And 7 years later, went off on my own.
That's great. I love that path. And you've worked now with over 200 composting facilities around the world. That is pretty awesome. I hope to get to see that many in my coming days. And what are the characteristics of the sites you consider to be doing a really good job?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you know, I have been from large scale facilities, I mean huge scale, to small scale. And I think, you know, as the industry has grown, the better composting facilities are, they're indicative of the people who manage and run the facility getting a good handle, a good understanding of the composting process, you know, going deeper into just piling it and aerating it, but to better understand a little bit more of the science behind it. Good facilities control water on the site. I think that that's a big, big deal that we often underestimate. I remember doing work in the UK many years ago, and they would say to me, oh, we get so much rain, you know, we're not going to be able to compost well. And I remember saying to them, don't worry about the rain that comes from the sky. Worry about making sure your compost piles have dry feet. Make sure that you mm-hmm. have hard surfaces. And they found exactly to be the case. That, you know, so better production pads is key. Having the mm-hmm. appropriate amount of storage. One of the biggest problems we have is having enough space, and especially at large high-tech facilities where there's such a huge investment going into technology, that space is often forgotten as one of the most key aspects, and enough space to compost it long enough and then be able to properly store it. I mean, I've been to many sites where people have made beautiful, beautiful compost, and then they put it in a low spot on their facility and mm-hmm. water collects around it, or they're in a place where weed seeds from another field blow onto their product. And, oh, it makes me crazy, crazy, crazy. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, controlling odors, that is mm-hmm. key, because that's the thing that shuts us down. And then, yeah. You know, hopefully as they get better and better, they take marketing more seriously and they staff up for marketing where appropriate, you know.
I see a lot of farms that it's exactly what you're saying. They're making a great compost, but then they store it in this like swale area. And I think that they're thinking like, oh, this, I can put more in here because it's a low spot. But you see that wet feet and those anaerobic conditions happening. And it's just that also, that's one of the things that makes me cringe. And all the, you know, there's so the flies mating in that stagnant water and just kinds of problems happen with that.
And you think about, boy, you've made all this financial investment into making this quality product, and you kind of just taken a little shortcut there. So we have to get smarter about that. And people who are making a small volume of materials, you know, for a while they were actually putting breathable covers over some of the piles. So you still can't put it in a low spot, but you can protect it from a lot of extra water and from weed seeds blowing on it. But no, I think that that's a really, really important aspect. And I think the more composters understand their site, they understand wind direction and slope, you can get smarter about where you stockpile that finished product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I feel like space is one of those things that just you can never have enough space.
A lot of composting sins are cured by more time. So you don't have more time unless you have more space. Yeah.
Yep. I'm always balancing that, struggling with that a little bit.
No doubt.
So for this crowd, which is mostly regenerative farmers looking to grow vegetables mostly, what defines a high quality compost in your mind?
Right. People would think that that's quite an obvious question to ask and an easy answer. But I would say to you, first and foremost, you have to have a product that suits the crop that you're growing and soil needs. Okay. And so I only say this because, if a lot of people who are listening to this are actually producing their own compost, keep in mind now, if you're growing tomatoes or something that really require a lot of nutrition, well, then chasing feedstocks to make your compost out of that are high in nutrition makes a lot of sense. If you're growing plants that are crops that are more salt sensitive and don't like a lot of nutrients, well, then you have to keep that in mind. If you're making manure-based products, you're going to have to use it at low application rates or dilute it. But more generally, obviously, it's important to meet any contaminant limits, whether they're heavy metal or pathogen related. So we have to make sure we meet our PFRP temperatures and we know what's coming into the system. We have to make sure there is not a lot of physical contamination, which is a major problem today with the recycling of food waste, which of course I'm a fan of, but it is getting more critical to manage inert contamination then. And then really, proper moisture content on the back end, so typically that's 50% or under so we can spread it, but that's depending upon your spreading equipment, of course. You want to compost it long enough to make sure it's stable. Remember, for all the end users there, back in the old days, we made bad compost. We applied compost that wasn't finished, and then it kept decomposing quickly in the soil. And there's a whole different dynamic that occurs in the soil. So, we want to compost the stuff to make a stable, mature product before we use it, right? And we can test for that. So it's easy. Yep. It's easy to do. We can use CO2 evolution and other things to test. And then, of course, make sure, test for your pH and your salt content to make sure that your application rates to the soil don't negatively affect the crop that you're growing. Mm-hmm. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. It's every single person has answered that completely differently, and they're all great answers. This one is one I've read your articles about, and this next question's just been in the farmer world a lot. There's been a lot of concern about phosphorus leaching into water, particularly from compost made with animal manures, which are the good rich ones usually. We've actually experienced here even farmers getting cold feet about using our compost, even especially because it has high levels of a lot of things, but phosphorus as well. But can you talk to us about water extractable phosphorus versus organic forms?
That's great, because this is a really important aspect, I think, for our industry moving forward, as well as the reuse of other materials like manures and such. And I've done a lot of work over the years in erosion control, and I wrote the national standards for creating these coarse composts that are used in erosion control. So the movement of more important, I think sometimes we look past the obvious here. Unless you're in sandy soils, there is not a lot of phosphorus that's going to move through the soil and get to the aquifer, okay? The bigger concern is erosion and phosphorus moving horizontally on water, okay? So, you know, while we do have to certainly be concerned about phosphorus overuse, because that's a major issue, and chemical or inorganic, a lot of inorganic phosphorus forms are very rich, 85% water extractable P. Okay, so they have a greater, there's a greater concern of it moving through leach water, leaching water. But the first thing we have to do is if we incorporate this compost into the soil, especially clay silt soils, there's a lot of innate binding that occurs based on the pH of the soil, okay? So the first thing we have to do is make sure that we're not eroding soil, right? And that if we're using these materials, it's far enough away from moving water. So I think that that is the first and most important thing to talk about. Now, we've been using inorganic forms of phosphorus. And, you know, we create this phosphorus. The chemical companies create this phosphorus by extracting immobile phosphorus forms from rock. And then they turn it into a more mobile form. So that is their goal, all right? We can now test what I call brown products, right? Organic matter-rich products. And we can do a water extractability test. The test is done differently than they test most fertilizers. The test method is pretty well tried and true at this point. It's being used by labs. It was developed by a group of Southeastern agricultural scientists that were looking at the usage of manure and then biosolids to better understand phosphorus movement. So water extractable phosphorus, you know, the test is used for carbon-based products, okay? And it is going to take it's going to test that fraction of phosphorus that actually is movable, that's not bound to the organic matter. It is important to know. A lot of us have gone into looking at phosphorus to say, okay, well, you make compost and you compost it and you make organic phosphorus. Well, that's not true, right? We make organic. We convert ammonia N to slow release or organic N, but that's not what happens with phosphorus. Most of the phosphorus in compost is still inorganic, okay? Yeah. But it's bound. It's bound because of cation exchange and because of other nutrients in the soil. So what we're finding is a lot of the composts are really, really low, like low 20s. To 10% maybe water extractable phosphorus. Now, the interesting aspect about this is that this water extractable phosphorus is less likely to go and to be available in leachable water. But, you know, based on products we've used in the past in the soil, they seem to be available over time to the crop. So this is an area of research that we still haven't completed, okay? Is so if we put down this more slowly releasing phosphorus that probably these microbes have to, you know, break free of the organic matter to make them more available, what microbes are doing it, what situations are doing it, is that phosphorus getting to the plant? And we actually need more long-term studies on that. But the fact is we can do testing right now for water extractability, and we can get a good predictive understanding of the leachability of the phosphorus. And I think composters need to do that. Just like I tell composters, well, when you test your compost for nitrogen, spend a few more bucks or work with the labs that give you, you know, total nitrogen, organic nitrogen, nitrate nitrogen, and ammonia-based nitrogen. So you have a better idea of how much of that nitrogen is actually quickly available. And in a lot of cases, it's only 10% or less, you know, that's quickly available. So here's the difficulty that we sit today. We can do the testing and show that we have a low extractability. We can even grow crops. And if the crops are growing okay, then we know that the plants are getting phosphorus. Okay, so, but how do we show nutrient planters or get them to look past total phosphorus in the soil when they do their nutrient plans? And this is the dilemma that we're in right now, is that a lot of nutrient planters are looking at total phosphorus, and they say you can't put any more phosphorus into the soil. But they're not discounting for the fact that some of the phosphorus, a bunch of the phosphorus we're applying, is going to be slowly metered out of the soil over time with microbial activity. So we're really in a difficult place right now, I think, when it comes to phosphorus. And until some of the phosphorus management plants start using these coefficients that are based on phosphorus availability, it's going to make certain applications in farming difficult. And I think we got to get past that hump in the short term.
Yeah, it seems like the regulators are using just chemistry as the lens instead of biology as well.
And I do also...
It gets much more complicated.
Well, yeah, one other aspect of it, too, is that we know that there are different soil tests that you would use based on where you are around the country and based on the chemical makeup of the soil and pH and other things like calcium in the soil, that there are better soil tests to use to figure out how much available P there is. So based where you are in the country, you have to make sure that you have to ask the questions to the labs and make sure they're using the most appropriate soil test when it comes to, you know, looking at phosphorus. And there's a lot of literature on that. And most of the labs are probably doing that, but I do think it's important to mention that.
Hey, you all, Farmer Jesse here. The goal of No-Till Growers is to help produce and create valuable niche content like what you're listening to now. We create several different podcasts, from the Winter Growers podcast hosted by Clara Coleman to the Collaborative Farming podcast with host Jackson Rolette and many more. We produce videos at the No-Till Growers YouTube channel, including farm tours and crop-specific breakdowns. And our entire model is to create helpful, valuable farming content that is free and open to the public so anyone, anywhere can use it. So if you appreciate that and our work, or are simply enjoying this show, please consider signing up to be a patron at patreon.com/no-till growers. There are also other support options at no-till growers.com, or you can even purchase a copy of my book, The Living Soil Handbook, because when you purchase it directly from no-till growers.com specifically, the proceeds go to making you more amazing content like this. Okay, that's my spiel. Thanks, you all. Back to the show.
So can you talk a little bit more about how bacteria and fungi impact phosphorus? Because it seems like that's like the missing key for how we relate to it. I know it's super complicated.
And I don't feel overly prepared to talk about that because I have not delved into that science to look at what are the microbes that are in effect here. So I feel a little, I feel unprepared, and I don't believe in riffing when it comes to science, you know, and so I apologize for that, but perhaps I can do a little, research on that moving forward and we could circle back to it.
Yeah. I'd love to do that again. Yeah. Okay, so that's all great information, and it sounds like we just need to do so much more research, and that's exciting. I feel like the soil world is so untapped in what we know and what we could know, so there's a lot to, learn.
Well, I agree, and I think we all know in regenerative or sustainable or organic ag, we're fighting headwinds a little bit to the industry. And the types of products the industry creates at large, and therefore what's being funded research wise. So, you know, it's hard. It's hard for us to do this, but, yes, and part of the issue too is the research is long-term issue. We're not going to get an answer in this, you know, and, I was just doing work with actually a biosolids entity, and they had the money set aside to do this research. They have a very low water extractability, 2% on their base product, okay? And part of that's because of iron content in their material and aluminum. We haven't been able to find a grad student. The university, we have the money set aside, and we don't have the grad student to do the work, and it's multiple year work. So this, you know, we got to get moving. We really got to get moving on some of this. Right. And I do also think we need to, you know, look at, obviously soil texture when it comes to this, because I don't want to minimize, the concern of phosphorus or nitrogen movement. And it's much more prone to move in sandy soils versus denser, you know, silt and clay soils. And so we need to be, you know, we need to be doing comparative testing so we have a better read on this. So, you know, that's one of the things I think listeners can do is start pushing the university system to say, look, we need this data. And this data relates not only to compost and to regenerative ag, but also the way biosolids and manures are recycled. It's all this data, all this research is related. So it benefits all of agriculture doing this work.
Sure does. Yeah. I was just thinking that like the basic tenets of regenerative ag are going to prevent a lot of the problems with phosphorus running off the site. We're keeping the ground covered with plants, and there's higher organic matter. We're focusing on soils, and that alone is going to make a huge difference.
I totally agree. However, it is important to note that, based on the research, there's more water extractable phosphorus in manures than there are other feedstocks. So, you know, it is important work to be done, but I would agree that the new type of agriculture, which is really the old type of agriculture, it provides much more levels of safety when it comes to that, including keeping that soil covered, no doubt.
Yeah. All right. So you've authored hundreds of papers on compost, and are there a couple of nuggets from these scientific papers that you want to get out to the composters out there and these regenerative farmers?
Yeah, I think one of the things is don't be afraid to be a nerd. And what I mean by that is I really got very, very interested because of my scientific background and research that I did in school to better understand, you know, the attributes of compost. And of course, I worked with the U.S. Composting Council to start the Seal the Testing Assurance Program and better understand, you know, what the test data means. So I think one of the important aspects is, you know, for farmers is understand your soils and understand your compost, right? The compost that you're using. But then if they're marketing their compost, if they're actually going to produce compost and sell it off the farm, be able to talk about the value of the different attributes. You know, it can be hard for us to put numbers to paper when it comes to this, but, you know, nutrients in compost are more valuable, as crazy as it sounds, are more valuable to turf managers than to farmers. Okay, well, why would I say that? I only say that because, especially with traditional farmers, well, the nitrogen forms that they buy are very cheap, right? But a turf manager may buy a nutrient form of nitrogen that's three or four times the value. So if I'm making a compost with slow-release nitrogen in it, they may value that more. Now, with regenerative ag or organic ag, if the cost of nitrogen is already high, well, then you get that. You know, you get that fact. But, you know, applying less water to the soil, there's a benefit to that. Hard to quantify a little bit because, frankly, water is so cheap in many places. I started testing compost for humic substances. And you can purchase these substances, so we know the values of things like that. So I think understanding the attributes of the product are really, really important because it can actually help you focus on where the best applications for that compost are. Back in the old days, I used to joke, my compost was the best forever use. And it was because there was no other compost selling against me back in 1984. Okay. But yeah. Now we have all these other products and you could look at the attributes and then the applications and say, this product is better for this application. So understanding that is really next level thinking, I believe, because, regenerative farmers may find, well, I'm going to make a high nutrient and a low nutrient compost on my farm, and I'm going to use it for the different applications, right? And so I think the more you know about that kind of stuff, the better. And what I'm delving into, of course, is, you know, if there are things we're adding to the soil anyway, like, well, could be lime, it could be microbes, it could be humic substances. Well, how much do we know about what's already in that compost? Are we looking that deeply into it? So I think that's the next level thinking that I think is really, really key. And then, you know, the only other thing I would say is for people out there who are marketing their compost is, understand the needs of the people that they're selling to. And then you can actually have more intelligent conversations where people really understand. I mean, we really have to get past compost being deemed as really, really expensive fertilizer. I mean, you know, it's going to be all about soil health.
Yeah. This is the crowd that knows that. This
I agree.
Is the crowd that proudly wears the nerd badge and is, you know, pumped up about all the microbes.
I think that that's really, really true. I think that that's really, really true. So,
That's great. Yeah. And use your compost and experiment with it. And, you know, we've been making compost here for 45 years and we've added nothing to our fields but compost all this time, and they're just amazingly productive. And I can't like stress enough just how exciting it is when the water is just, when it rains, it can just soak in, and like I can hear it. There's a noise that when you can hear it like trickling into, getting so deep into the soil and not having to water as much. You know, we had a huge drought this summer and barely even had to water because it's holding that water even.
And let's face it, that is not typical. It is just not typical. Yeah. I mean, it's huge. We have huge issues all over the fact. And, as I talk to, whether it's people who are using product in the landscape world or in ag, you know, it seems pretty basic. You know, we have to increase organic matter. We have to make the soil be able to accept the water, or as I tell the Californians, the free water, right? Let's get the free water and get it into the soil. We can't. I live in North Carolina. Where I live, the water hits the soil and goes horizontally.
Yeah, that's so sad.
It's very, very sad. But I mean, it seems so obvious, but besides slowing down climate change, we're not going to be able to keep up with feeding people unless we can, you know, figure out a way to do this by fixing the soil. So
yeah, and it's I don't want to underestimate just the joy of working with a healthy soil that can do that. Like, I'm looking forward to planting my garlic because I can just stick my hand deep into the ground. It's going to be nice and soft, and I can get that garlic in beautifully deep, and it's just so fun to work with. And I've worked on plots before where it's, you have to like chisel a hole. That's not fun.
Well, I mean, that really is the case. So I mean, we're at a dawn of a new era. But the point being is that there is a serious reeducation that has to occur in larger scale agriculture, and we need to be showing the proof. We need to continue to show the proof to say, look, this works, and we can get really good yields, and we can lower our inputs. So.
And we need that paper behind it to back it up.
Well, you do. Yeah. You really do. You really do. But you know, also, I think I do work in California in the Central Valley, where there are some huge composting facilities, and they're able to get very inexpensive compost out there. But they know the benefits they're getting now. Within these drought conditions, first of all, they are improving those soils, and they're putting down decent amounts of compost. This is in more traditional ag, and we just got to keep those trends going. You know, we got to keep that trend going. And
I'm here to support that trend. So here we are. great. Is there anything else you want the audience to know, or resources you want to suggest?
Well, the only other thing I would just say is, you know, we're in the digital age now, where we get data by looking at our phone, and I think it's important to continue to commit ourselves to reading real science and reading real research and not being afraid to read a 10-page really finely typed piece of research to get real data. So I just think we're in the position where we have to work a little harder and get smarter so we can have intelligent conversations and understand what's going on. So it's just, you know, just like we handle the soil, the better we handle what's going into our brains, I think the better we're going to be, we're going to work in the field. So I just say, keep getting educated. Keep getting educated and keep working.
Great. Any resources you recommend for that? Any journals or anything?
Well, I would say BioCycle magazine, but that's they have an online magazine when it comes out. But I just think you have to look at I can't name regenerative ag journals off the top of my head, but even if if a farmer finds a really good piece of university research, to pass it around to your friends, right? So they can see this and say, look, see that? Everything we thought we saw, it's right there.
They can pass it to me. I'll share that with
through there
this
you
podcast.
Go. There you go.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you going to be at the Compost Conference, the U.S. Compost Conference this
January?
Oh,
yeah. And that would be another recommendation. And that would be to, if you can get to a conference, get to a conference. And, if there are smaller composters who want to come to this, things that are relevant to every size composter are presented at these conferences. And, you know, if you let the U.S. Compost Council staff, I used to be a board member of the USCC, and you let them know. And, if we know there's going to be a bunch of regenerative farmers there who are doing agriculture, we can find a way to get some tables together and where people can have a meal and you know, and have a smart discussion. And,
because I
think that's one of the differences in our industry, where we seem to be more willing to share information, which makes us unique compared to a lot of other industries. So, I do think getting out is really an important thing, even though everybody is so busy. We don't learn a lot talking to ourselves. And, but thank you for the opportunity and I hope as I do more work, then I have the opportunity again to speak with you and your audience.
Yeah, I would love to chat with you again. Yeah, thanks so much for being on. And just for the audience, that conference, that U.S. Compost conference is in January, I think like the 24th to the 27th of January.
In Ontario, California, which is about 30-40 miles east of L.A.
Yeah, great. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ron Alexander.
Great to talk to you. Have a great day and have a nice week. Bye-bye.
You can check out Ron Alexander's work and many of his articles, including his paper on phosphorus, at alexasoche.net. I want to give a huge thank you to Jesse, Jackson, and Michael from the No-Till Growers. Without them, the show would not have happened. And I hope you will listen to the great music of Soulshot. Check them out at soulshot.net. Deep gratitude to all the compost lovers listening out there.